Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday the 3rd of January, these are our main stories. President Lula has joined the crowds of Brazilians who've been paying their respects to the footballer Pelé ahead of his funeral. There's been condemnation from across the Arab world of a visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem by a far-right Israeli government minister. Pakistan's government outlaws production of electric fans as it struggles to pay for energy. Also in this podcast, Japan changes its traffic laws to allow automated delivery robots on public highways. And a warm snow crisis for skiers in the Swiss Alps.
Look at this snow. It's really wet, like in spring. For skiing, the snow needs to hold together. There's just too much water in this. It's impossible.
Tens of thousands of people in Brazil have been paying their respects to the football legend Pelé. They queued through the night at the Santos Stadium to file past his coffin, waving flags and chanting. Among those attending was Alberto Pfeiffer, a resident of Santos. He told us how he would remember Pelé.
He arrived here in the mid-50s, so he became part of our daily life. It's part of our stories. It's part of our conversation. It's part of our family life. It's our community. It's kind of family. And the feeling that we have is that someone who is being like the most important person of our family has gone away. But at the same time, it's a good feeling in terms of we've done a lot of things together as being part of this culture. I was there earlier today. It was massive. It was impressive. I mean, the lines, the queues, kilometers, miles, people there, thousands, tens of thousands of people taking the queue, taking the line to pay tribute to him. However, it was not sad. The atmosphere was more about nostalgia and good memories than about sadness. It was more positive than negative. He was always around as a humble guy, very friendly, very smiley, very joyful. He got this kind of trait that we have here in Santos, that is to make fun of everything, of everybody. So he was, I mean, the guy who you didn't know, but after 5 minutes of chatting, he became your best friend.
The newly inaugurated President Lula joined mourners as a priest led them in prayer, then a hymn, over the coffin before it began its final journey for a private family funeral a short distance away. Just before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our Brazil correspondent Katie Watson among the crowds in Santos.
Well, we're at the Vila Belmiro Stadium where Pelé's coffin will shortly be departing and going through the city of Santos. There's a big supporters group that's waiting. They've been dancing samba, playing the drums, waving flags, many with the number 10 shirt that Pelé made so famous. They're expected to accompany the coffin through the streets. But this is a moment of mourning, but it's also a moment of celebration and remembering this man that so many people called the king of football here in Brazil.
And there were queues right through the night to file past his coffin at the stadium.
Absolutely. I spoke to one man who was the first in on Monday, and he wants to be one of the last to go and see Pelé again. That's how much this man mattered to so many people, especially Santos, because of course he played at this football stadium, but Santos Football Club is so much a part of this city, and Pelé so much a part of the city and the club. And it was his wish to hold a wake here, and tens of thousands of people have come to pay their respects. It was a searing hot day yesterday. It's still pretty hot today. That's not put people off through the night. People were still paying their tributes, and Lula was one of the last. And interestingly, when he drove through, we were there, and there was a lot of anger for those who dislike Lula, support for those who love him. And I think that's exactly, you know, this is a country that's deeply divided politically, but when it comes to Pelé, there is very little division. Everybody here has fond memories of him, feels so strongly that not just for football, but for the country, he did so much for Brazil, and that memory will endure.
What next? Are there any longer-term plans for honouring him?
Well, we heard from Infantino, who said that he wanted to name a stadium across the countries that people should name stadiums after Pelé, that the younger generation shouldn't forget him. I think that's a pretty unlikely scenario here in Brazil. I think everybody here for years to come will remember him. There's been no formal plans of what's to come, but no doubt everybody, and especially here in Santos, there will be a commemoration for Pelé.
Katie Watson in Brazil. On Tuesday morning, Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's far-right security minister in Benjamin Netanyahu's new government, posted a photo of himself on Twitter, a picture which has sparked Arab fury. Wearing a Jewish skullcap, he's seen at the compound where the Al-Aqsa Mosque stands in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem. Muslims call the area the Haram al-Sharif and revere it as Islam's third holiest site. Jews call it the Temple Mount. For them, it's their holiest site, but Jews are forbidden from praying there. The holiest place where Jews can currently pray is the Western Wall below. Mr. Ben-Gvir's visit was as much a religious as well as a political statement, and the Palestinian militant group Hamas said he crossed a red line. Ahmed Al-Dik, a Palestinian foreign ministry official, gave this warning.
We condemn this provocative breaking in, and we hold the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, directly responsible for this. And we consider this breaking in as an official Israeli invitation to a round of violence that will be hard to control.
With more on the visit, here's our Jerusalem correspondent, Tom Bateman.
It took place first thing this morning. Itamar Ben-Gvir entered the site surrounded by Israeli police and security officers. He spent around 13 minutes there. There was no indication that he actually approached the Al-Aqsa Mosque. He was in the compound itself, and no indication that he prayed at the site. But the point about this is that Palestinians see this as an incendiary move when a senior Israeli politician visits the site. And that is because of the very significant religious sensitivity, both to Muslims and to Jews, of the site itself. He had said over the previous months, before he became Israel's national security minister, that he wanted Jews to be allowed to pray at the site. Now, that would be a change of the historic status quo that is accepted at the Haram al-Sharif, as it's known to Muslims, and the Temple Mount, as it's known to Jews. Now, it had leaked in the Israeli press over the weekend that he may visit this week, although there was no clear indication of the timing. It was then suggested the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had sort of put a lid on things and that it wasn't going to happen. We had a statement via the Lebanese media from Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, that said that there would be explosive consequences if Mr. Ben-Gvir visited the site. And then we had news that it had happened first thing this morning. And already a scathing reaction from neighbouring Jordan, which is the custodian of the site. They have said this is a violation of the status quo. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry have called this an escalation and said that there is the real threat of violence. And as for Hamas, well, they describe this as a visit by the fascist Ben-Gvir. They called it a crime and said the Palestinian people will continue to defend the sanctity of Al-Aqsa. I think the point about this is you have to remember that Itamar Ben-Gvir is an extremist figure. He leads a party called Jewish Power that espouses racist and anti-Arab policies. He controls the police in Israel, crucially, the militarized border police in Jerusalem and occupied East Jerusalem itself, where these holy sites sit. And I think what he's trying to do is to sort of pitch himself against Hamas. He's saying to his own supporters, you know, we will make sure that these holy sites are open for all. He tries to pitch this as discrimination against Jews at the site. And, you know, that obviously then leads to fierce rhetoric from Hamas. And I think people are worried that what's really happened here is that the extremes are in control of the situation, or could quite quickly and easily become in control of the situation. We were often asked in the run-up to this government, would Mr. Netanyahu be able to control these far-right extremists like Ben-Gvir? It seems pretty clear from the events this morning, the answer to that is no, although the visit was short and, as I say, no indication that there was any prayer on the site. But I think Mr. Ben-Gavir is trying to pitch himself against Hamas, really to empower himself further among his own base.
Tom Bateman. 28 bodies have been found in northwest Burkina Faso. The authorities say they're investigating the killings, which took place in the town of Nouna on Friday. Lala Sy reports.
Burkinabe prosecutors said the victims, mostly men, had been shot dead. Rights groups claim they were killed by a civil defense force recently launched by the government to help fight an Islamist insurgency. These units are given minimal training before working alongside the security forces. Burkina Faso has faced 8 years of attacks by jihadist groups with thousands of deaths and millions forced from their homes. The instability has seen two military coups in the past year and growing international concern that Burkina Faso is loosening its ties with the West and strengthening its relations with Russia.
Our West Africa correspondent, Lala Sy. Anyone planning a big wedding jamboree in Pakistan had better get their skates on. That's because the government in Islamabad has just announced a crackdown on electricity use in a bid to tackle a desperate energy crisis, and it includes a 10 p.m. curfew on marriage venues. Let's get more on this from our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Etarajan.
Pakistan is facing a huge electricity shortage, and the government is struggling to pay for the imports of liquefied natural gas and fuel oil, which can power many of these power stations in Pakistan. So they are having also the load shedding, power cuts for several hours, depending on which city you are living in. So that is why the government is now wanting to save foreign currency reserves by asking people to ration electricity use. And malls and markets, they've been asked to shut down by 8:30 p.m. And many of the weddings, they happen during the winter time. And now the government is asking to reduce the number of hours they are hiring a wedding hall or in any other wedding avenue. And the government thinks that by saving this electricity, they can save dollars, because their currency position at the moment, foreign currency reserves, they are less than $7 billion, enough to pay for a few weeks of import. So the country is going through a variety of crises. One of them is the economy, and that is why the government is taking these desperate measures.
Yeah, that lack of foreign currency reserves makes me think of Sri Lanka.
Many countries are facing this is a similar situation in the region, and Pakistan, many people thought it could become the next Sri Lanka, as we discussed about how Sri Lanka ran out of money that led to the shortage of food and fuel. And Pakistan is in a similar situation. There are fears that it could be facing another debt default, because it has to pay about $1 billion in the coming weeks. They have only $7 billion, even though China and Saudi Arabia, they have parked billions of dollars in Pakistan to shore up the reserves. They cannot use the money. And also, remember, Pakistan faced a devastating floods a few months ago. The country is yet to recover. One third of the country was underwater. So it needs more money. It needs investment. It needs more people to send money back home from, like, Pakistani workers. And that is why Pakistan is really worried. Even though they have money from the IMF, it is yet to be released, because Pakistan needs to, you know, work on certain conditions like cutting down on expenses, trimming down its subsidy programs. That's going to cause a lot of dissatisfaction among the public. And that is why Pakistan government is in a very difficult situation.
Very briefly, banning electric fans in the blistering Pakistani summer.
Well, at the moment it is winter, but what the government is arguing is that, for example, any local fan made using electricity, they use 120 watts of power and more power, whereas the modern fans nowadays, imported ones, can use half the electricity. And that is why they want high electricity consuming fans production to be halted, so that they can even save more electricity.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Winter resorts across the Alps are starting their ski season with very little snow following record warm temperatures over New Year. In Switzerland, some resorts have closed their slopes, while others are relying on artificial snow. Imogen Folks reports from Bern.
In the ski resort of Adelboden, a battalion of snow cannon prepare the ground for this Saturday's World Cup race. The famous slope is a narrow ribbon of white, winding its way through green pastures. The champion skiers will hurtle down to the finish line on artificial snow. It's the only way this race can go ahead. But in the resort of Splügen, at 1,500 metres, once considered snow safe, the slopes are closed. Hachar Berne, director of Splugen ski lifts, says there was no choice.
Look at this snow. It's really wet, like in spring. For skiing, the snow needs to hold together. There's just too much water in this. It's impossible.
On New Year's Day, the temperature in Switzerland reached 20 degrees Celsius, a record north of the Alps. Some resorts have opened their summer biking trails rather than try to offer skiing. But thousands of livelihoods depend on the busy months of February and March when families across Europe head to the Alps expecting to ski. Snow needs to come and it needs to come soon. But for now, the weather forecast remains very warm and very wet.
Imogen Folks. Automated delivery robots are to be allowed on public roads in Japan from April under revised traffic laws. It's hoped the machines will help overcome the country's chronic labour shortage. Will Leonardo reports.
In recent months, there have been a series of trials across Japan of delivery robots transporting everything from food to parcels. The machines move at the pace of a brisk adult walk and are equipped with cameras and traffic light detection systems to avoid collisions. Updated laws mean they'll now be able to ply their trade along Japan's often narrow city streets while being monitored remotely by humans. One company involved in the trial says it eventually hopes one person can oversee 10 working robots. That's good news for the Japanese government, trying to deal with a shortage of workers, especially in the logistics industry. Recent surveys suggest more than half of all Japanese firms are unable to find enough full-time employees. In a statement to local media, the Labour Ministry said it hoped the robots would be of particular help in regions where populations are declining, fuelled by a rapidly ageing society.
Will Leonardo. Coming up in this podcast, why hunger is a risk for 3,000 captive elephants in Thailand.
When COVID happened, everything came to a standstill. Everything got worse. So now we have to save money all the time to buy food for the elephants.
The authorities in Beijing have responded angrily to the decision by several countries to demand a clean COVID bill of health from Chinese visitors and warned that they might retaliate in kind. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said the restrictions were unreasonable and lacked any scientific basis. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, told me what had annoyed the Chinese authorities so much.
Beijing is angry because they feel there that China is being unfairly singled out, that these restrictions are only being imposed on people coming from China, and they're questioning why. They're also pointing to the beliefs of many scientific officers in many countries that such testing simply isn't necessary. For example, in Australia, health experts in Australia have said it's not necessary. Australia has such high vaccination rates itself. It's not really at risk. Why ask for tests for those coming from China? Now, Australia's health minister has decided to ignore that advice and impose such travel restrictions anyway. And that's just one example where Beijing says these restrictions are more political in nature instead of reflecting health concerns.
But the health concerns are there, aren't they? And that they are that China has been operating in a completely different bubble to the rest of the world. And it is possible that there are deadly strains circulating within China that could be spread to the rest of the world if precautions aren't taken.
Absolutely. So the countries that have decided to impose such travel restrictions, including Japan, France, the United States, they're saying, well, look at what the WHO is saying. The World Health Organization just last week very publicly criticized Beijing for failing to release real-time health information on the explosion of COVID inside China. The WHO is calling for more information on hospital admissions, deaths, those in intensive care, and of course, very importantly, which variations are passing around China. Now, the real problem is that China has been very clear that they aren't really tracking this information anymore. Their test and trace systems have really broken down. And so China itself doesn't really know what variations are passing around the country right now.
Celia Hatton. An American football game being shown on primetime US television was suspended on Monday night after one of the players collapsed. Damar Hamlin, who's 24, needed CPR after apparently being hit in the chest by another player's helmet during a tackle. Nick Hamilton is a reporter and US radio host who was watching the game between Hamlin's Buffalo Bills and the Cincinnati Bengals on television.
It was such a really bizarre, it was a textbook hit. He jumped back up. Approximately 5 to 10 seconds later, he collapsed and immediately alerted the medical staff of both the Cincinnati Bengals and the Buffalo Bills to render aid to him. Spoke with a couple of people that happened to be near the scene, and they informed me that he was actually had CPR performed on him in order to be able to transport him to a local hospital where he was accompanied by his mother inside the ambulance. The players, from what I were told, I mean, you can see the emotion, you can see the reaction on both sides of the field. Someone that was there, like I said, informed me that they had saw, you know, players crying, players were in shock. They were absolutely in disbelief. There's been an update on his condition. According to his marketing manager and friend, Jordan Rooney, he said, quote, his vitals are back to normal and they have put him to sleep to put a breathing tube down his throat. They're currently running tests and they will provide updates as they have them via Twitter. The next 48 to 72 hours are obviously going to be very critical. It could be believed that he suffered some type of cardiac arrest, whether that be because of the hit that he suffered on the field or something prior to, has still been determined.
U.S. radio host Nick Hamilton. Still in the United States, the new Congress convenes today, with Republicans taking control of the House of Representatives by a narrow margin after the midterm elections in November. They'll be voting on a new speaker for the House to replace Nancy Pelosi, one of the most important roles in American politics. But that candidate, Kevin McCarthy, may not win enough support from fellow Republicans. So to explain what's been happening, strategist Scott Jennings, who used to work for former President George W. Bush, has been talking to my colleague Michelle Hussein.
Well, Kevin McCarthy is a congressman from California, and he has been trying to become Speaker of the House for many, many years. About 7 years ago, in fact, he made a bid for Speaker that was upended, and he backed away from it and then went back into the House Republican Conference and eventually became leader of the Republicans and has gotten to this moment where he's led the party to reclaiming the majority. The Republicans won 222 seats. That's enough to have the majority and to elect the speaker. And now a few of his members are saying they won't vote for him. So it's quite a perilous time for Mr. McCarthy, who's had a lifelong dream of becoming Speaker of the House.
Which members are saying they won't vote for him and why?
There are five members who you would consider to be from the right-wing fringe of the Republican Party. And they simply don't like Mr. McCarthy because they say he's part of the Washington establishment, that he's part of the Washington swamp. And these are people you may have heard of. Matt Gaetz is one of them. They're often in the news causing quite a bit of trouble for the Republican Party. But the Republican majority is 222 out of 435. McCarthy needs 218 votes on the House floor in order to achieve the speakership. So if five Republicans abandoned him, he can't get it. And so these five have been causing this trouble. And as of right now, we don't know how it's going to turn out.
Is this about the influence of Donald Trump?
Well, interestingly, Donald Trump is backing Kevin McCarthy. Donald Trump has called on all Republicans to support Kevin McCarthy. And Kevin McCarthy has been a steadfast supporter of Donald Trump. However, it appears Donald Trump's influence has some limits because these members are not listening to Donald Trump, despite being what you might consider to be some of the Trumpiest members of the House Republican Conference.
If he does get through, if Kevin McCarthy does get through, how much of a thorn in the side and how much of a problem for President Biden will the Republican-led House be?
Well, they certainly will have investigatory power. They can issue subpoenas and they can look into various things in the Biden administration, such as the pullout from Afghanistan, the crisis at the southern border of Mexico. They can look into Hunter Biden, the president's son, and all the issues surrounding him. So when you have the majority, you can subpoena just about anything you want. So that's one way they can be a bit of a thorn in President Biden's side. Of course, also, they won't pass any of President Biden's agenda. There'll be a block on his agenda, and they'll have to negotiate with the White House about any legislation that will be passed.
Republican strategist Scott Jennings. Like many countries whose economies rely heavily on tourism, Thailand has been badly hit by the COVID pandemic, and its more than 3,000 captive elephants used to entertain tourists for decades have also been affected, with their owners left struggling to feed them. Visitor numbers have started to recover, but many now view using the animals for entertainment as unethical, forcing the industry to reevaluate its future. Jonathan Head has been finding out more.
It's the annual health check in Bantaklang, a village in Thailand's northeast, where for many generations people have lived with elephants. One by one, the giant animals are manoeuvred into a specially built barn by their mahouts or handlers. A vet throws a tape measure over their backs and checks for any ailments. During the two-year COVID shutdown in Thailand, many of these elephants returned here from the work they'd been doing in tourist resorts. And as a result, says volunteer vet Nutupon Bankow, their health has suffered. As more elephants have moved back here, he says, we started to find problems with their digestive systems. It's because of the stress of moving, and also with their owners so short of money, they're now getting the wrong kinds of food. Wandering around Bantaklang, it's quite normal to come across elephants and their mahouts out for an evening stroll. The traffic here has got used to edging around them. Most houses have an elephant or two in their front yards. We met Joy, who has four elephants that she brought back 2 years ago from the holiday island of Phuket.
COVID had a huge impact on us. Previously, I worked doing elephant treks for the tourists. That gave us a salary to support our lives. But when COVID happened, everything came to a standstill. Everything got worse. So now we have to save money all the time to buy food for the elephants.
Even as tourism starts to recover, there are other questions hanging over the future of this kind of elephant business. Up in the north of Thailand, near Chiang Mai, Lek Chai Lert washes three of the 122 elephants she now has in her camp. Lek is a pioneer of a different kind of elephant tourism, where there are no rides, no performances, and no chaining the animals up. They're free to roam, and visitors just look at them. It wasn't easy at first.
Everyone want to go to touch, want to go and hug elephant, and they want to have hand-on elephant. But for us, we make decision already, and we lost 50% of the booking.
Now, though, her elephant nature park has become popular with the growing number of tourists who want a more ethical experience. Marianne is from Spain and Dina from Canada.
This is, I think, one of the few places on Earth where you can see captive elephants so happy and having, you know, such a good environment and freedom.
The problem is tourists don't stop and think. They obviously don't question why an elephant is looking sad or looking worn out or looking hungry.
The Thai government has yet to come up with a long-term strategy for its large population of captive elephants, one which meets the demand for higher ethical standards while still ensuring the livelihoods of the thousands of people who depend on these magnificent animals. And with elephants typically living well past 60 years of age, the problems they pose will be around for a long time.
Jonathan Head. Think of the best environment for delicate life-saving surgery, and the odds are you'll think of a sterile operating theatre, silent but for the whir and beep of high-tech machines. What you don't want, surely, is anything to get the surgeon's foot tapping as he wields the scalpel. But, as Mark Duff reports, it may be time to think again.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
You can always trust a smoochy old crooner like Tony Bennett to keep the heartbeat steady under pressure, can't you? Right? Well, maybe not.
It calls to me.
Slow music isn't necessarily the best option of music in the operating theatre.
Michael Koh is a surgeon and professor at the University of Hong Kong. He's been studying the impact on medical teams and their patients of using faster and slower music.
According to our study, there was no difference in terms of the surgical complications as well as the blood loss among patients who were being operated under the influence of background music, slow music or fast music, or even no music.
So no difference in patient outcomes, i.e. the success of operations, but Michael and his team also found something else.
We found that the operating time was significantly shorter in the patients who were being operated by a surgeon listening to fast music. We believe that it's the music in the background that subconsciously affects the pace of the surgeon. It's just like listening to those fast music in a gym. We tend to run faster with fast music.
All of which begs the question, which is Dr. Koh's favourite music for operating?
If I have to pick one, I would pick Crocodile Rock. It is a very happy song and it boosts up the mood of the entire surgical team.
That report from Mark Duff. And the surgeon, Michael Koh, who we heard there, is a regular listener to the Global News podcast and actually suggested his story to us. So if you've got a story which you think might be of interest, why not let us know? You know where to find us, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. There are other ways to get in touch with us as well as that email address. You can find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. We'd love to hear what you think about this podcast, all the topics covered in it. This edition was mixed by Gareth Jones and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Whatever you're looking for in a podcast, the BBC World Service has something for you. From untold legends, Aura, tracing the story of a gifted black sportswoman's struggle for recognition in segregated America.
Aura was an athlete at a time when the world wasn't really paying attention to African American athletes.
The Coming Storm, investigating the rise of the QAnon conspiracy theory threatening American democracy.
A world of parallel realities. An epidemic of disorientation.
When everything that you thought was true about things is shown to be false, you kind of question everything.
To season two of The Bomb, uncovering a gripping true story of espionage at the heart of World War II atomic research.
Klaus Fuchs was the perfect spy.
He'd given the Russians the plans to the plutonium bomb.
This was going to change the world.
You can download and listen to Untold Legends, The Coming Storm, and The Bomb in full now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.